You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, September 28th, 2020. I'm Matt Leck on a Matt, Brendan, and Jamie Monday on the five-time award-winning Majority Report, broadcasting closer than ever to the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal and the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Today, Sam's out, but we have a pre-recorded interview with him, with Aaron Kleinman, Director of Research at the Future Now Fund and GiveSmart, to discuss this year's most important down-ballot Democratic candidates and how they'll impact policy on a state and local level. Also on the program, the New York Times obtains tax return data on Trump, finds he paid just $750, three digits, in 2016 and 2017, and none at all in several previous years because his businesses report losing money. President Trump's former campaign manager, Brad Parscale, was taken from his Fort Lauderdale home by police Sunday afternoon after his wife reported that he was armed and threatening suicide. Also, as the world approaches 1 million COVID deaths, the World Health Organization warns 2 million is not impossible. Also, Lindsey Graham lays out a timeline that could have Amy Coney Barrett seated before the end of the month. And the next month, I should say. October. And a Kentucky State Police ballistics report does not support State Attorney General Daniel Cameron's assertion that Breonna Taylor's boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, shot a Louisville police officer the night before she was killed. So, cops saying things that aren't supported by the facts. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Folks, thank you for joining us. I hope your weekend was a good one. No, Sam, today it's Yom Kippur, which maybe we should release for members. Brendan and I trying to guess what Yom Kippur was. The Day of Atonement, Brendan informed me. I think he's here. Hi, Brendan. How are you?
Hey, Matt. How are you? I'm doing well. Everyone who's out there atoning today, we see you. We hear you. You're valid, although only, Yahweh can, or I don't know. What's the word for Jewish word for God?
I don't know if you're supposed to say it. Yeah, I think so.
Oh, okay.
But excuse me. Yeah, so I mean, we might have really stepped in it already. So maybe we should, we don't have any ads today. Jamie will join us after this interview with Aaron Kleinman at Bobby Big Wheel. What was the thing? What was Sam's mistaken? He tried to guess Aaron's at on Twitter once, Big Fat Daddy.
Yeah, Big Fat.
It's not
pretty good. Not that.
Aaron is not Big Fat Daddy on Twitter. He's Bobby Big Wheel. And here's this interview. And like we said, Jamie will join us for a quick fun half today at the end of this. We will see you on the other side of this.
Welcome back. Joining me now, it is a pleasure to welcome back to the program. He is the Director of Research for Future Now. He also has another, I can't remember what the other position is you have. Aaron Kleinman, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me, Sam. And I'm also the Director of GiveSmart, something that we can talk a lot more about while we're here together.
In fact, I'm looking at your report. I always break this out just to remind myself of Disco Stew. I learned about the Disco Stew fallacy from you. I am old enough that I don't understand memes. And so you were the one who explained it to me. I appreciate that. And that is, of course, Disco Stew saw famously that disco sales were up 400% for the year of 1976. And he was like, hey, we should get on this whole disco thing, because if these trends continue, they're going to be, and of course the trend did not continue, did it?
It did not continue. And so everyone, if there's someone out there saying, hey, this trend from say 2012 to 2016 is just going to keep continuing, you should be be wary of anyone peddling that, because things tend to be a little more cyclical than that.
Yes, and remember to what happened to Disco Stew. Aaron, and I should also say, you're, of course, on Twitter, Bobby Big Wheel, right?
That is correct. I chose that screen name back in 2008 and just never got around to changing it.
I understand. That happens. All right. So let's talk about this. I want to talk, obviously, you focus professionally on what's going on with state legislatures. Give us a sense of what is, when you guys sit down with this, and maybe even more broadly, what is the goal? How many state houses, how many state governments are in reach of Democrats in terms of control? And then we'll talk more about implications, because there's a whole lot of stories about state legislators that are important right now.
It's not just – so the main goal normally is flipping a state legislature from – flipping control so that Democrats would have a majority there. And so right now I think we're looking – but there are also breaking supermajorities. If Republicans, have a supermajority that they can pass over gubernatorial vetoes or some budget things. There's also, maintaining Democratic majorities in states where it might be a little precarious, or maybe even getting a Democratic supermajority in a state that might be trending our way. And so I think there's about a dozen real big opportunities in the states right now for Democrats to make big gains. And I think, for us in particular, we're looking at, we're I think in 13 states now, but I think, our
Baker's Smart Program, I think, is what we call that.
Yeah. Baker's dozen. But I think Arizona, Kansas, Montana, Michigan, New Hampshire, North Carolina are all pretty prominent plays of ours right now.
And those also, not just maybe not a coincidence, but not on a state level. These are also, I think there's some pretty big federal races there, too, that are sort of right on the cusp. Right. Arizona, we could have two pickups there. We could have a pickup in Kansas. Now people are talking. Conceivably, I'm talking to the Senate, also the Senate in Montana. Michigan, we're defending a Senate seat. New Hampshire, not so much, I don't think. But North Carolina, obviously, there's a challenge with Tom Tillis. So, and then the implications. So, I guess that's not a coincidence, right? We're talking about states that are sort of purplish states in this instance.
Yeah. One thing to keep in mind with all of this is the further you get down ballot, the more room there is for differentiation between the top and the bottom. And so, there's more room for these legislators or legislative candidates to really outrun Biden. But also there's, they need to make sure they have the resources so that, they actually, if a Republican candidate has more money than them, then, the opposite could be true. And the Republican candidate can do even better than Trump. And so it really is one of those situations where the candidates need to basically be able to get their message out, especially in such a crowded political atmosphere when everyone is advertising. In Montana, you're not going to be able to buy it, These candidates tend to not need TV ads, but every single TV ad is going to be booked for the last few weeks in Montana. And same goes for, Kansas, North Carolina. It's going to be really difficult to kind of cut through all the noise in all those states. And so it's really important that we give these candidates the resources they need to do so.
And so what are they doing with these, with the resources being money, I guess, but also expertise, I would imagine, on some level too. But what are they, are they going out and doing door-to-door campaigning?
So I think you and your listeners have probably seen that door-to-door campaigning is a bit of a hot topic right now, how safe it is. Under non-pandemic circumstances, door-to-door campaigning is the most effective kind of one-on-one voter contact method. We are in pandemic circumstances right now. There's a lot of differing views on, it's the same as a pizza delivery guy versus you're putting people's lives at risk. I think the answer is somewhere in the middle there. So we have to make sure that, now that because especially for candidates, a candidate in themselves knocking on someone's door and being able to talk to them is the most effective way for them to kind of really persuade someone to vote for them. Now that they can't do that anymore, they have to rely on things like, phones and text and, digital ads. and you know these other forms of getting their message in front of voters. And again, that you know now that they don't have this free method anymore, they need kind of paid methods to get their names and faces in front of them.
So let's talk a little bit about the importance of these state houses, because there is a story that, I mean, this has been kicking around for a while, but last week there were two stories that came out basically about this potential for delays in the votes in different states, some involving shenanigans, some involving like a lot of legal gumming up of the works, et cetera, and then that presenting an opportunity for state houses to essentially take over the process of selecting electors. You know, like technically speaking, and I hate to break it to people, but not only do we have an electoral college that is in and of itself sort of anti-democratic, we also have a process of choosing those electors that can also be very anti-democratic. We vote for the electors, but we don't have to, because the state house, state lawmakers could choose them. And I know it's upsetting to your children. It's upsetting to me as well. But this is the story in Pennsylvania. Apparently, this is according to the Bart Gellman piece. They are starting to discuss this potential. And so, A, what happened? Like, it's the lawmakers who were sitting, who the lame duck lawmakers theoretically could decide this, right? And this is also indicative of a larger set of issues that are important about state houses.
Yeah, and well, so it's interesting that you bring up Pennsylvania and Florida as well for this, because in Pennsylvania and Florida, both of those states have legislators who have terms end in November. And so if Democrats can flip really one house in Florida, or really both houses in Pennsylvania, they could either stop or reverse even any Republican attempts after the election to use their inherent power under the Constitution, which you alluded to before, to choose how the electors are chosen. There's a bit of a wrinkle in that, because there's the safe harbor provision. Do you know about that at all?
Yeah, explain that to people.
Yeah, so basically, under federal law, there's a safe harbor provision where basically a state's method of choosing electors is locked into place on election day. And so if the electors are chosen pursuant to that method, then it kind of gets the benefit of the doubt when electors are presented to Congress in the reading of the Electoral College, essentially. So if a state wants to basically decide, oh, no, we're not doing popular vote, actually, we're going to decide basically whoever has the majority of seats in the legislature gets it instead. Under the safe harbor provision, they'd have to decide that basically before the election, or Congress would not be able to defer to it. That limits their ability somewhat. But if there is a close count in a state, they can actually try to basically pass their own state of slate of delegates saying, oh, well, you know, a court or a secretary of state said that one person won, but we actually think the other person won, and then it would leave it to Congress to decide. This hasn't happened before, but it almost did, because in 2000, Republicans controlled the Florida legislature. So if the Supreme Court had ruled that the recount could continue and that Gore had ended up pulling ahead, they were ready to pass a law stating, actually it was the Catherine Harris certification of the vote that counts and not the recount, and that it would have thrown it to Congress to decide which was the actual count based on the method that they chose to choose electors on November, I think it was 6th that year.
Now, it's not such a slam dunk in terms of the Congress deciding, you know, which, because at first blush it's like, oh, well, in that case, Nancy Pelosi is the majority leader of the House, so we don't have to worry about this. But that's not the way it works in the House, is it?
Yeah. So I know that if there's a tie, you know, if there's a tie in the House, or if there's a tie in the Electoral College, for example, then it basically each state delegation would vote on, you know, which the winner should be. And right now, Republicans hold a 26-23 with one tie majority. Now, this would be the Congress that's elected as of November 3rd, because they would get inaugurated before they chose the electors. So there's a chance that Democrats, I think, Montana is probably the likeliest state for them to be able to flip, because there's one seat there and it's open. There are, I think, some longer shots out there as well. But basically Democrats would need to flip one or two delegations to really, in that scenario. I think disputed states of electors is even more unprecedented, and there'd be real chaos. But, I think that ultimately partisanship would really rule the day in terms of how it's decided, which, is not healthy for democracy, but it really highlights the fact that Democrats really need to flip as many House and Senate seats as they can, in case someone really tries to subvert the will of the people like this.
Right. I mean, this is one of those, there's obviously sort of a second order a value to running up tallies. You have more of a cushion to pass certain things. Theoretically, you can get more progressive legislation because you can afford to allow some, frontline Dems, as they call them, to release them on difficult votes. But this is more first order problems in terms of getting this in. All right, so let's put all that to aside for a moment, right?
Yeah.
And we have this, and then let's just look at the presidential election, because you study this. Obviously, your Future Now is focused on these state races and the idea that if you invest in a state race, you're getting pound for pound. You're basically exercising more influence on your political process because, I think that's well established, and obviously that's what you guys are doing. But let's talk a little bit about the presidential election and sort of where you see the polls are, because I know you look at this stuff as it is. Putting aside for a moment the idea of the red mirage and that on – well, let me ask you that. I mean, if you have a sense of this, how well do you think, based upon where the polls are now and the sense, at least – which is not a fixed number of how many Democrats versus Republicans are going to vote by mail versus in person. Like, how far ahead at 11 p.m., let's say, on November 3rd, do you think Donald Trump will appear to be?
I don't think he will appear that far ahead at all, because you're going to have different states reporting different things, and you'll have a state like Florida or North Carolina or Virginia that typically counts their votes pretty quickly. And they'll be showing, kind of close to what the actual results will be. So even if there's a huge Trump lead in Pennsylvania, and it's because all of these rural counties have reported way more votes than these more dense counties where a lot of Democratic voters are located and where Democrats are really making gains. I think, we're involved in Pennsylvania as well. And we've seen in the Philadelphia collar counties, like Bucks County and Chester County and the Lehigh Valley and kind of the suburbs of Pittsburgh, we're seeing a lot of like movement toward Democrats. And that's going to be a source of, we think it will be a source of real strength for them. But it'll just take longer to tabulate. More Democrats will vote absentee. So there will be a bit of a red mirage there. But you'll be able to see in the national picture a state like Florida. So if Florida is like leaning toward Biden, but Pennsylvania's, voting like 65-35 for Trump, outside of like the gateway pundit and some of the worst bad faith conservatives out there, people are going to know what's going on. So it's not something I really worry about as much. I mean, what I really...
You're not as worried about the red mirage, as it were.
Yeah, we'll be able to suss it out pretty quickly. Just because, like, if there is something going on, there's no reason for, Pennsylvania to shift incredibly far to the right when neighboring Ohio, it doesn't. Especially because like Eastern Ohio and Western Pennsylvania politically are very similar. So if you see kind of a divergent result on that state border, it's because of how they're counting votes. It's not because of some underlying political movement that we missed.
This is good. This is the first good news. I mean, it's not great news. It's just like, let me put it this way. It's the first not bad news that I've heard in a long time, which is that at the very least, this notion of a red mirage, and I think the more people talk about it, the the less the chances are that they're going to be able to manipulate it into something that is going to influence the outcome of the election originally. And for those of us who lived through Bush v. Gore 2000, this is a big fear, because literally the Supreme Court said, we're going to interfere with the vote. We're not going to allow you to count votes, because that could make people think that George Bush was not the winner. And yeah. It is... And we don't want to predispose, like, the Supreme Court knew the value of that perception on that day after the election. And so, the Trump people surely do. The difference, of course, I think at this time is that the news media is not, broadly speaking, is sensitive to this issue right now. Yeah. And they're not going to come out and say, oh, my God, Donald Trump seems to have won. And then the Steve Kornacki, the guy with his shirt sleeves rolled up, is like, hey, wait a second. No, all the ballots aren't counted. Don't worry. We'll get to you. That's the scenario that I think people are afraid of. And if you're suggesting that something like, so Florida, who are the states that are going to announce on that day? Like, who counts their ballots? Basically day of or prior to that we will hear a more or less a projection, unless it's super, super tight, that are potential swing ballot states. Like if Joe Biden is announced the winner of Florida at 10:30 on election day, can I say goodnight to the people who are watching and say, like, you're going to be able to sleep for the first time in several weeks?
I would say, if he's winning Florida, like, all right, I'll even go a little one step further. We have kind of a tool that we use called Varun, where we basically run a bunch of different scenarios, how the national vote would change and how it manifests itself at the local level. There's a county in Florida called Seminole County, north of Orlando, kind of upscale suburban area, historically Republican, but it's been trending Democratic. I would say that if Joe Biden is winning Seminole County, it's a great sign for him nationwide. Considering everything we've seen, I don't want to say if Joe Biden's declared winner of Florida, that automatically means he's president. I think there still is a scenario in which there might be some type of, you would basically still need to see some type of rural surge in upper Midwest. But if he's winning Florida, it means he's probably winning he's probably doing well in North Carolina. North Carolina is another state that'll be pretty early. I would say, I think we're still waiting to see a few other states, but I think Ohio should report pretty quickly. Virginia, even though it's not really a bellwether anymore, just seeing how he does there compared to 2016 will be indicative of kind of larger shifts. I mean, again,
Joe Biden went to Ohio and Florida. Hasn't he basically won it? I mean,
Oh, if he wins Ohio and Florida, yeah, he's won. Okay. So
chance in Ohio, you think?
They keep having polls showing it really close. Part of it is too. He's been on air a lot more than Trump in those states. The cash advantage, plays to his advantage. And again, in Florida, we can see the shifts at the local level as well. And so what we're seeing there really in our races is Biden really is improving among, in what's called the I-4 corridor, which basically runs from like Tampa to Daytona Beach through Orlando. He's doing a lot better there than Clinton was.
Those people?
Mixture of kind of older voters where Biden's doing a lot better.
The big story, right? Is that Joe Biden is doing so much better with white older voters than people would have anticipated. Is that the big story?
Yeah, it is. That is a very, I think that when we're looking back at what happened on the election night, a big story will be he's doing well among those. And we're seeing that, in our districts, we've endorsed candidates in a lot of districts where, it's Florida. You have a lot of, retirement communities around. And, at the local level, we're seeing those shifts. But one thing that we are a little worried about in Florida is that Trump does seem to be gaining ground in Miami-Dade, especially in the Latinx in districts that involve a lot of the Latinx community down there. And so that's where even if Biden overperforms a little bit in those areas, if Trump can, you know, really cut into his margins in Miami-Dade, then it still could be a problem. There still could be problems for Joe Biden. You actually saw this in 2018 where like Bill Nelson outperformed Hillary Clinton just about everywhere except for Miami-Dade, and that was enough for him to lose.
Let's just stay there for a moment. If Donald Trump nominates Barbara Lagoa, although I guess, you know, we're recording this on Friday, we're going to know tomorrow, Saturday. So if let's just assume for a moment that he did on Saturday, we're talking on Friday, but this is running on Monday. If he did nominate Lagoa, if you were advising Donald Trump, and you don't care about, first of all, if you're doing that, you don't care about anything. And I'm really disappointed in you, Aaron.
I'm sorry.
But nevertheless, I'm over it. Yeah. Okay, so now you're advising Donald Trump, and you're just talking about politics. You're not talking about, how draconian or how much, this justice wants to throw this country back to, the Robert Barron era. You're just looking at sheer what's going to drive votes. Would you say you got to pick Lagoa because you want to win Florida or not?
So, first of all, you can hear that when you said me working for Trump, it actually made my kid cry. I don't know if you heard that. That's
I did.
Really disturbing stuff. What I would say is,
Daddy's being hurt. Daddy's being hurt. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I would say, what I would try to do is I would desperately try to find a potential justice that had gone on the record saying that the ACA shouldn't be overturned, because that is the big issue in the Supreme Court.
Should not be overturned?
That's right. Because the ACA the ACA battle, what Republicans had put forth as this big issue, we can tell now it was all a fake. They just didn't like Obama. They didn't care about this law. But now what you're seeing across the country is Republicans basically lying about their record on health care. From Trump on down, even down to, from Trump, you have Senate candidates, even the state legislative level, saying, oh, we're going to protect people with pre-existing conditions.
They're suing right now, incidentally.
Yeah, exactly. So they're suing right now. And what Democrats can say is, by the way, this ultra-conservative Supreme Court pick, whoever it may be, is going to rule that this is invalid, and it's going to invalidate all, this entire law that protects people with pre-existing conditions. And so, if you wanted to be incredibly cynical and be Trump, say, find some, a conservative who nevertheless has said that this law is actually constitutional.
Is there? You wouldn't know the answer to this question. Maybe this is more rhetorical, but is there a single Republican justice or conservative justice in the country who did not say that the Affordable Care Act was the end of Western civilization?
I can't think of one. Because here's the thing with the court fight. I think if the election is about health care, then Trump loses, because
I've been thinking about that, because 2018, you would hear some people saying, like, I don't know. I just remember, some basically left-wing trolls who would come on and say, like, people can't make this election about Trump. And I'm like, everything I've been hearing from people who are reporting is that every single candidate out there, maybe that's a slight exaggeration, but maybe not, was talking about healthcare, because this was on the heels, or in the wake, I should say, of the Republicans trying to roll back the Affordable Care Act. This is the whole John McCain thing. And they were all talking about health care. Is that happening again this time?
Absolutely. So the election doesn't take place on Twitter. Where the election really takes place more than anywhere is on local TV ads. And if you talk to anyone in a swing state right now, most of the ads coming from Democrats are about health care. Most of the ads from Republicans really aren't healthcare, but a lot of them that are lying about their records. Like, I know Cory Gardner in Colorado is basically saying, I'm going to fight to protect pre-existing conditions. He owes his entire career to opposing Obamacare. If the election becomes about, really confirming a Supreme Court justice who wants to undo this, then it's bad news for them. And then you know, with, hopefully this can carry really everywhere because, you know, we have candidates running in all these states where, you know, Medicaid expansion is a big deal. I mean, this, and again, it really shows you the stakes here. If they do manage to confirm another ultra-conservative Supreme Court justice, then it really is, you know, the whole conservative project is really just making it impossible for Congress to pass laws that improve people's lives.
Right.
And that fight then goes to the states. So if you want things like clean air and clean water and affordable health care and good jobs and investing in children, then you're going to have to, you know, Congress will have their hands tied and it's going to have to be a state by state fight.
You know, there was a great example today, Friday, again, but this is still resonates through Monday, of the EPA basically saying that they are no longer going to they're going to stop going forward with the ban of a pesticide, chloropyrifos, which is found to not only make farm workers sick, but also a neurotoxin to children.
Yeah.
Now, most human beings, well, I don't want to say that. Most people who really, you know, have any sense of empathy or compassion for other human beings, any respect for other human beings would say, hey, something that creates is a poison to children's brains, literally, that's a bad thing. We should not actually promulgate its use. That is not what the Trump administration has done or the EPA. But what was interesting about this, so they rolled it back. It's now legal for you to use this. At the end of the piece, several states, including California, New York, and Hawaii, these are big, big agricultural states. Uh-huh. California is, people surprised, New York, also very big agricultural state, have already enacted bans of varying strictness against this thing. And so Corteva, the world's largest manufacturer of chloropyrifos, said it's going to stop producing the chemical by the end of this year. So in other words, like the ability to capture the legislatures of states can actually implicate national policy in a big, big way. International policy in this instance, we see it with California, like the CAFE standards. Trump wanted to roll them back, and California's like, we're not doing that. And then the car makers are like, California's our biggest market. It's not worth it for us to create polluting cars versus non-polluting cars. We'll just do the less polluting cars, I should say. And in this instance, these states, because they're controlled by Democrats, have basically implicated, you know, in a de facto way, the policy of at least the biggest manufacturer of this stuff, and then it becomes out of reach, and you've saved little kids' brains, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what we're talking about here. I mean, one of our states for 2020 is Michigan. You know, obviously, anyone who's followed the news in Michigan knows that clean water there is a huge issue, and you have this right-wing legislature controlled by narrow special interests that just refuses to do anything about it. And so, you know, if Democrats can flip the Michigan House this cycle, which they're only three seats short of, then all of a sudden, you know, there's just going to be less lead in people's drinking water. And if you want to talk about, you know, there's this election where you have, you know, democracy is really on the ballot, but the forces of authoritarianism aren't going to go away after losing one election. You have to keep beating them for a long time until they become irrelevant. And so, well, how do you win election after 2020? You know, assuming we do well in 2020, it's you have to improve people's lives. And doing stuff like this, making so that they have clean water, making so that their children aren't being poisoned, making sure that, you know, Medicaid is expanded and that, you know, people don't have to pay more than $25 or whatever for insulin. You know, these are the types of things that will help you keep winning. And so that's what we're trying to do. And that, you know, so, you know, again, if you support like state legislative candidates, they're really close to the ground for the people on these issues. And you're able to affect people's lives a lot more directly with them. And so that's really why we do what we do.
And it's also a big redistricting issue too, right? I mean, we have the census coming out, and if you can control the state house, you control redistricting. All right, so a couple of things I just want to reiterate on these major takeaways. One, Seminole County, and I hope we're going to have you on our election coverage on that day.
I might be in a catatonic state, but I'll see what I can do.
Well, you should also know it's the 10th anniversary of this show. just coincidentally falls on Election Day this year. So you're joining.
I'll wear my tuxedo.
But Seminole County, Florida, is the one that you watch. Is he any in the way? Like Macomb County? Doesn't everybody like her?
So Macomb County is in Michigan. That's actually no longer a bellwether. In Michigan, I would check Kent County, home to Grand Rapids, and make sure if Biden's winning Kent, it's a good sign. No, in Florida, because Florida's going to report results quickly, I would say Seminole is one of them. Pinellas is – that's where St. Petersburg is. He should win. If he's losing Pinellas, that's a really bad sign. But he actually can win that and not win statewide. So you'd better be hoping that he's winning Pinellas. Also, Duval County, home to Jacksonville. That'll be a key – if he's flipping Duval, that'll be a key sign that he has the strength, especially among African-American voters, that he needs to carry the state.
You mentioned earlier about what you were noticing in Pennsylvania in the suburbs.
Yeah.
Are those like wealthy college educated people who are basically shifting from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party?
Yeah, some of the I mean, I don't know how wealthy they are. You know, it's not, you know, it's not like the fanciest suburbs really aren't the ones where it's, you know, really kind of middle class, you know, white picket fence, you know, college educated areas where in Pennsylvania, we're really seeing some of the big shifts from Republicans to Democrats. Pennsylvania, you know, we think that the issue there in my Pennsylvania actually seems like it might be closer than Wisconsin and Michigan this time around is there are two things that might be going on with the rural vote there. Historically, Michigan and Wisconsin are a bit more Yankee just culturally in their rural areas, which means they're a little like less prone to voting Republican, at least in 2020. And so their rural areas have shifted more toward Democrats than in Pennsylvania. And also Pennsylvania is a state where the oil and gas industry is still incredibly powerful. And so, yeah. And so it looks like Pennsylvania may be actually the tipping point state again in 2020 after 2016, people thought it might be Wisconsin. That would be the tipping point. But again, and you know, so we're in Pennsylvania. We're trying to, you know, flip seats all across the state, you know, not just the Philadelphia suburbs, but also there are a lot of well-educated areas that have historically voted Republican that we think, if, you know, around like Harrisburg and even Lancaster. And so Pennsylvania, but you know, Pennsylvania on election night, the state officials have said, we're not going to know who wins for at least a few days.
At least. So, I mean, I think the deadline for absentee ballots is 6 days out. I mean, so,
yeah,
you know, and that's being contested right now, I think, by the Trump administration. But we shall see. All right. So let me ask you this, just as a general theory. I know that the notion of down ballot races having coattails is a little bit controversial, or maybe there's not a lot of data that shows that's the case. But I am skeptical about that to a certain extent that, you know, because we have a situation where the last two elections for Democrats, where you've had a tough time getting people. Well, in 2016, one of the big problems was you couldn't get voters out to be enthused about Hillary Clinton. People were also unenthused about Donald Trump, but it just so happened in the right or the wrong places. It was just a slightly different, you know, a little more unenthusiasm for Clinton in three states. Doesn't what you guys do, like if resources go to, you know, to Jenny Stevenson in, you know, a certain district in Pennsylvania, if she gets resources to drive more people out to vote for her, isn't it likely that they're going to end up voting for the top of the ticket too, and that's going to help?
In Pennsylvania. So, I mean, it is a controversial thing, and I don't want to kind of tell people to give me money based off, or not me, but give candidates money based off of something that's really not entirely proven. And so, I mean, if you think about it just from like an efficiency standpoint, what's the most efficient way to get people to vote for Joe Biden? Giving to his campaign directly or to giving to someone else on the ballot? I think it ultimately is giving to him directly. And in terms of the reverse coattails effect, which has been speculated before, it, you know, the biggest study on it, the most well-known one on it, found there was no correlation. I think it is a little outdated. It was really based on elections from basically from post-World War II through 2004 when partisanship wasn't as strong.
Right.
So it could be out of date and that there might be some impact, but we just haven't seen a study of that caliber come out yet to show that it really does have a meaningful impact. So I hesitate to make my case based on that just because the evidence isn't great. That said, I think donating to these candidates is worthwhile in their own right. Even if it doesn't impact the top of the ballot in this election, it impacts the top of the ballot in preceding elections.
Right.
And so it's not just redistricting. I think that's the one that people think about the most when they're thinking about, how state legislators impact federal elections. But what they do is that they set the material conditions of future elections. In Wisconsin in particular, I think you really saw this, where they flipped the state legislature in 2010. They basically would go all out war on basically liberal institutions in that state. They defund colleges. They destroy public sector unions. They have an all out war on voting rights. And so that's really, I think in Wisconsin doesn't flip in 2016 unless Republicans just do their scorched earth campaign after they flipped the state in 2010. Mm-hmm. And so that's really where the impact is felt. It's felt further down the line. I would say if you're not enthused about Joe Biden, but you want to maybe help out someone else, there certainly could be an ancillary impact where a candidate that you donate to of ours in Arizona or Michigan.
That's why I ask.
Yeah.
I think there are people who are, Joe Biden's not my first choice. Joe Biden's probably not my second choice. Or my third choice, but he's my first choice in the presidential election because he's the only one who can win against Donald Trump. And for a lot of people, I think there's a reluctance, in this audience, not broadly speaking, although there may be, I can't get motivated to go out and raise money or donate money or work for. And there's varying degrees of that. And that's, all well and good. I'll go vote for him. But my argument has been to folks is then find a local candidate that you like, whose policies are more simpatico with yours or their politics, and do everything you can to promote them. Because at the end of the day, if the benefit that goes to them is some of it is definitely going to run off on Joe Biden.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, if you're not enthused about the presidential race, get enthused about making change at the local level and, not just any candidate, we have people that can really make a difference in people's lives here. If you want to, again, we have a slate, if you want to go to futurenow.org/givesmart, we have, first of all, we have basically the eight candidates to support at any moment that need the money most, more than anyone in the country. That's our featured slate. And so, again, we look at polling, we look at district fundamentals, we look at cash on hand information, other campaign finance data, and we can find the eight candidates at that moment who could use basically small donations more than anyone else. And you're making the biggest difference possible when you donate to those candidates. And we have state-specific slates as well. So, again, in Michigan, if you want to help them get clean water, we have a Michigan slate. In Kansas, if you want to help them expand Medicaid, we have a Kansas slate. And so you can really make a difference in people's lives and maybe have a positive ancillary impact on the Biden campaign. But really, this opportunity only comes around every, 2 years to make this impact on state legislatures. And so if you're not enthused about the presidential campaign, you can still make a huge difference at a time when it's really meaningful through this.
Well, Aaron, I got to tell you, you've changed my life because I cannot tell you how many times people say to me, where should I send money? And I say futurenow.com/givesmart. That's what I do. Now I don't have spend a lot of time talking to people, and that changes my life.
I'm really glad we can provide that. Futurenow.org/givesmart. Also,
.org. Sorry. Yeah. Oh, well, that's why people keep calling me back, and they go, "There's nothing there."
Yeah, we're always promoting it on Twitter as well, Future Now USA, or me personally at Bobby Big Wheel.
What is going on at your house right now?
They're tearing up some glass, some cardboard. I'm sorry about that,
Brendan. Construction going on at your house?
No, they're basically
Who's the they? Your family?
No, a worker had to remove some. We had mold in our kitchen.
Oh, jeez. All right.
Yeah. Good thing we're pre-taping this.
we're not going to cut this out.
Okay. Again, but all the money goes direct to candidates, even though I just had to pay to get mold removed from my kitchen because my upstairs neighbor's washing machine blew a gasket. Doesn't go to me. Money goes directly to those candidates who need it the most. And so that's how you can really make a difference. And, you know, there's one other thing that I really want to talk to you about in making a difference in this election, Sam. Are you familiar with the comedian Tim Heidecker?
Don't start in on this, all right? This Heidecker. Okay? Because that's I'm that guy.
George. I gotta warn everyone about this guy.
Yeah, I know. I went on a show. He was horrible.
No, have you listened to his music?
I actually have listened to I Am a Cuck is one of my favorite songs. But besides that.
No, but like I had to listen to a song of his about Donald Trump. And I'm just like, oh my God, this is why people hate Democrats.
Oh, because of the mocking.
It's so wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I'm so much smarter than you. And like, it gets people to hate Democrats. And I'm just terrified. I'm terrified, Sam. That people will listen to these songs and vote for Trump. I think I really want your donations too, but if you can't afford to donate to us, I just need you to really tell Tim or tell like Spotify to stop promoting his stuff. Just tell your friends, just don't listen to Tim Heidecker's music. It keeps me up at night worrying about his impact on the presidential election.
Yeah, Heidecker, okay. Weesh, bad stuff. Well, Aaron Kleiman from Future Now, check out futurenow.org/givesmart. People check that out. And, of course, Bobby Big Wheel on Twitter. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
All right, folks. Let's see. We'll get Jim here. I haven't declared my allegiances in the Tim Heidecker beef yet.
To Sam or to Tim?
Yeah.
You haven't assessed blame for and not to either party?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that show sounds kind of funny. I like all the sound drops they do in it. So I don't know. Kind of spoke to me a little bit. I kind of see Sam's point, but I also, you know, also I think the Tim Heidecker, it's free real estate little gif, it just makes me laugh maybe more than any. I don't know. People know what I'm talking about. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Of course. Of course.
Okay. Yeah.
It's free real estate.
This message is for Jim Booney.
Yeah. But do we have Jamie? Let's see here. I don't know if she has access to the link. But folks, we'll get to the fun half in a second here. But before I do, we want to get to this Trump tax story. And I think we probably want Jamie to join us for that. But, here's this. Just while we're waiting. here is Tim Heidecker, what I'm talking about when I mentioned the free real estate thing. I don't remember what this is. Here it is.
It's free real estate.
So, anyway. here's Jamie joining us. Nomad Binderbinder will join us on Thursday, I imagine. Hello, Jamie.
Oh, hey. Hold on.
How are you today?
Let me turn down the volume in the background. I'm all right. It is the Day of Atonement. I have a little correction that I would like to atone for, but perhaps we'll do it at the top of the fun half.
Are you correcting something that was in the fun half, or was it in the first half of the show?
Oh, it's something that I said last week.
Was it? But I'm saying, was that in the fun half, or was it in the first half? Because maybe we should.
I don't remember. Fun half.
It was the fun half for sure.
Save it. we can save that. We also in the fun half need to get to John Lydon of the Sex Pistols wearing a Make America Great Again t-shirt. I believe John Lydon, and I don't know my Sex Pistols, but he's the one that's saying, "You ever get the feeling like you're being cheated?"
I think that's him
at the top of the show. So I don't know if we just keep appropriating this guy. Christian, we'll get this in the fun half, but a little bit of scandal has hopefully.
We could just get John Benjamin to say that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just hope John Benjamin doesn't show up in a Make America Great Again t-shirt. That would be a big scandal for us.
I feel like it would somehow fit in, though, with his long-running beef with Sam.
That's the next stage from I'm losing it, bro.
Yeah, it's escalating.
He's just a Trump supporter.
It is Johnny. It might be Johnny Lydon.
I think it is. So before we get to the fun half, I think we should cover this tax story before, and maybe we can just play. Maybe we can just play Trump's reaction and denial, or as the press asks him before we play some old sound of him complaining about taxpayers. So if we have
People know about the tax story, right? Do we have to introduce what's happening?
Let's introduce it a little bit. Basically, it turns out that, surprise, and also this wasn't because the Democrats forced him to relinquish his tax returns. The New York Times obtained them and found that, 2016 and 17, he paid $750 total, which is, I had to look at that closely. Like, I thought, like, maybe he paid, like, I guess that's it. I wish I paid that small of an amount on federal income taxes.
Seriously. But,
maybe Trump was one of the 45% Mitt Romney was talking about, I guess.
It's one of those things where you're not surprised, and yet you're still pretty mad about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, this is the thing, is like, yes, they should... We should pass laws that force these people to pay taxes, right? Like, I mean, how many different times does these things happen to happen? Like, whether it's the Panama Papers and tax dodging, right? Like, part of me gets upset at how rich people are enabled to do this, and then we act scandalized by it. I can't remember who said it on Twitter, but they said that we actually might not have been that well served by this norm we have of having presidential candidates release their tax returns, because it gives them because their tax returns are so meticulously curated, because they're going to be made public, they give you a wrong impression of what rich people's taxes typically are like. And it's typically things like this, like I've been losing money. And there's a corruption angle of this too. At Doral, Trump's golf resort in Miami, the Times said that a roofing manufacturer spent $1.5 million during a time when the roofing industry was asking to relax federal regulations on their business. He's losing money, and his hotel has this advantage. I mean, I don't think the Best Western can do that. Like, the roofers don't care about, you know, spending $1.5 million on that. Let's play this clip of Trump reacting to it.
I think everybody's going to be talking about is there's a New York Times story that came out about an hour ago that says that when you came to the White House, you were paying about $750 a year in federal income tax. They are not releasing what they're not publishing the tax returns. They're not showing that out there. They're saying to protect their sources. In your tax return, sir, does that sound right that you were paying a couple hundred dollars a year in federal income taxes?
It's fake news. It's totally fake news, made up, fake. We went through the same stories. You could have asked me the same questions 4 years ago. I had to litigate this and talk about it. Totally fake news. No, actually, I paid tax, and you'll see that as soon as my tax returns. It's under audit. They've been under audit for a long time. The IRS does not treat me well. They treat me like the Tea Party, like they treated the Tea Party.
Oh, God.
They don't treat me well. They treat me very badly. You have people that in the IRS, they treat me very, very badly, but they're under audit. And
yeah. So, and it wasn't just the $750 for those couple of years. There were years that he didn't pay any at all, which is, I mean, that's because I'm smart, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Should we play the next clip before we say any more critiques? Because I have some.
Yeah, let's maybe play that next one. This is the 2012 clip, I think.
Yes. Yeah.
So, and we drive people out. We already have the highest tax rate there is from a corporate standpoint and probably from almost every other standpoint. So probably. If he wants to keep raising taxes, I think that's fine. But people are going to leave. People have lots of choices. They could go elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Now, what happens if this is not going to pass today? They're not going to get the 60 votes in the Senate. But Senator Schumer, a guy you know, says they're going to hammer this thing all through the summer. What happens? Is this they play? Are Republicans playing into President Obama's trap?
Well, I think this is really just a populist thing that Obama's doing, and he's trying to do it. And probably it meets with a certain amount of popularity, in all fairness. It's probably, from a purely political standpoint, very good. The Republicans are going to have to be on their game. If they're not on their game, they're going to have a hard time. Because these are the kind of things that are bad for the country, but they play fairly well.
And you just said fairly. That's what the president's pushing between now and the election is fairness. And yet, Mr. Trump, you know, about half the country doesn't pay federal income tax. Is that fair?
No, it's not. And in fact, it's even more than that, as I understand it. And it's not fair. A large, large percentage do not pay. And it's interesting that he uses the name Buffett, because Buffett is locked into a huge tax dispute right now.
That's right.
We're having to do with NetJets, where they're trying to get close to $500 million of taxes that he didn't pay. And it's sort of an interesting thing. We're using the Buffett rule, but he's involved in one of the largest tax disputes in the country. And, you know, there's a whole thing going on.
You know, this is a good example of why Trump isn't as dumb as Ben Shapiro wants you to think he is. Like, the way he talks about, yeah, it might be a popular measure and the GOP needs to be on his game, that's good advice, frankly. Like, I mean, and this is where I feel like the left should have, I mean, we were not in a position to it at all when this was going on. But, like, patriotism, right? If you want to go somewhere else because we raise taxes, go. You don't want to have access to the world's largest economy? Fine. Bye. Like, that should not be a serious threat. But nobody was able to articulate that at a sort of mainstream level.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I thought this was going to be a clip of Trump being a hypocrite, but it turns out he was saying the exact same thing that he says over and over again. Like, he wasn't talking about billionaires who pay no taxes, right? He was talking about poor people. He was talking about the makers and the takers. It just turns out that he's a taker.
Yeah. And I mean, it is, the hypocrisy is, it's stark. And, you know, we can say all the things about the limitations of hypocrisy, but to be agitating, I mean, I feel guilty writing off this PC, which I've used every single day during this coronavirus, right? Like, this show has basically, like, we barely missed a step to transition, in large part because I bought this piece of equipment. But nonetheless, I wrote it off of my taxes, and I still feel some, like, guilt about it because I also enjoy playing, like, games on it. I feel guilt about that. This guy pays nothing because his businesses are such massive losers and then complains about, yeah, poor people not paying enough taxes. It's very, I mean, just, that's psychopathic.
Yeah.
And it's psychopathic in not in the dumb Ben Shapiro, I don't know what's going on way. It's the, I'm actually, like, putting my finger on these different pulses. And I still want to make sure that, you know, I use my platform to make it worse and keep tightening the screws and make it better for me.
Well, in his mind, he deserves to pay nothing in taxes because he's a job creator, right? And because he's just, like, special and better than everyone else because he is rich, despite owing more in debt than I will ever make in my entire life, probably.
Yeah.
But do we think this is going to move the needle in any way politically when he already told us in 2016 that he doesn't pay taxes because he's smart?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've established his people like that he cheats for them, like that they're on the inside of his cheating for them. I mean, MAGA is basically a celebration of winning an unfair fight.
Yeah.
That's basically what's going on there.
Yeah.
Will it turn out people? I mean, it could. I think Obama in his prime, like the way he like hit Romney with like faux populism, I think Biden has like maybe some of that. He seems to be rhetorically signaling that. I think that Democratic apparatus is so compromised, though, that it really, like, what should be a fire hose blasted at Trump is just going to be like a squirt gun. And it might be enough. And look, I mean, the Kleinman interview was somewhat optimistic in terms of, you know, where my mind's been in terms of polling, I guess. So I'm glad to hear that. But so it might be enough, but it's not going to, like, it should be an issue where the Dems can, you know, run these a-hole business execs out of power. But because the a-hole business execs also have control of the Democratic Party, that it's going to be compromised.
Yeah. I mean, we also have to consider the Kanye factor here, right? Because back in 2012, Kanye was on the Democrats' side, and he reminded everybody, Mitt Romney don't pay no tax. Mitt Romney don't pay no tax. Whereas now, the tables have turned. He's much more of a wild card, and we can't necessarily count on him to do that.
Yeah. I'm not. I'm certainly, in my calculations, I haven't been rely on Kanye personally.
Yeah, saying be, there are many factors to consider.
That's true.
It'll be interesting to see how Biden attacks this with, I think, a sense of populism, like you were saying, Matt, in Tuesday's debate. It's just a matter of, like, whether or not Trump's research team can find all kinds of, you know, awful tax avoidance on Biden's part, or Kamala Harris's part as well. Like, this can be flipped.
And we were talking about this earlier. We should get to the fun half, but I don't. One, they've lowered expectations for Biden again so low that he's just going to look semi-coherent, and everyone's going to think he's like on Adderall, which he might, of course, be. I mean, I wouldn't put designer amphetamines past anybody at elite level.
But no, I mean, I take them every day. It's great.
But the other thing is Joe Biden. Like, people are talking about, like, well, is there going to be a fact checker at the debate? How do we fact check? It's like, a fact checker would also hurt Joe Biden. Like, both of these guys lie with the absolute best of them, and with their body language and their tone and their attitude. It's one of the best things that makes them, one of the reasons that has led to their success. So, I mean, we all saw the way Joe Biden, like, I got as progressive a care as anybody. Like, no, you don't. You just don't, man. Like, he lies. So I don't know. I think Biden's gonna perform fairly well, but I think he can make that work. If he can't, I'm very worried, right? If he flubs the, you know, the you're a oligarch not paying taxes, we are in trouble. But I think it's kind of a layup. And I think Joe isn't the worst vehicle. He's a bad vehicle for that when you know about him, but just if you don't actually know about him and just know him as Obama's guy and, like, as a personality, he's a good vehicle.
Yeah, great. I agree. A lot of people judge these things on the level of vibes, and he's got better vibes, better populist vibes than Hillary did.
Well, look, yeah. Never mind, I don't want to bring that up. Let's get to the fun out. Jamie, you got plugs for this Monday?
Why, yes. So this week on the Antifada, or I guess I should say last week, we had on Aaron Thorpe, a.k.a. Posadist Trap God, on Twitter to talk about the Black misleadership class. He had some harsh words for Killer Mike, problems in Atlanta, the protests that are going on all over the place still, Posadism, white people pretending to be Black, and many more things. Then on Friday, we released a new episode of The Vampire Castle, wherein I, Jamie Peck, and Leslie Lee III from Struggle Session talk about cool vampire stuff. And this week, coming at you on Wednesday, Sean and Matt Chrisman have recorded a hot, fresh History is a Weapon, and I don't even know what it's about. They haven't told me yet, but I'm sure it's going to be great. And you can find all that at patreon.com/theantifada.
Tomorrow night, we're going to be doing a debate coverage on TMBS. We're going to try to figure out how to do that without getting copyright stricken. So we're going to do a member-only pregame show, and then do the sort of full show will be the debate coverage. So look for that tomorrow. And over the weekend, I went on twitch.tv/literary hangover and played Black Mesa, the remake of Half-Life, the original Half-Life game, while watching a documentary on J. Robert Oppenheimer and the creation of the nuclear bomb and sort of his, and coming to terms with the nuclear bomb was actually an Antifa project that all those guys thought basically the Nazi, we need to save the world from the Nazis. So it's particularly Oppenheimer because he, you know, had family in Europe. So it was an Antifa operation, and then all of a sudden the Nazis fall, and it still kind of continues and, you know, becomes a tool of the American state to basically control the world. So interesting documentary I watched, twitch.tv/LeaderHangover, watch that. We will see you on the fun hat.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.